everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food. Here we are. It's October 22nd, 2013. It's kind of a nice autumn in New York kind of day. And I just like breathing all that crisp, fresh air and thinking about all the wonderful fall foods that there are for us to enjoy, all those fall plant foods, right? Okay, today is a power pack show. We're going to be talking to some wonderful doctors, and I want to get started because the information that we are going to hear about is so very important. My first guest is Dr. Neil Barnard. He is the president and founder of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, a nonprofit organization based in Washington, D.C. His research has been published in Scientific American, the American Journal of Cardiology, and other major journals. He is the author of 6 previous books, including Food That Fight Pain and Food for Life, a frequent lecturer appearing across the country, and adjunct professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine. He lives in Washington, D.C. He has a wonderful new book out called Power Foods for the Brain, and we're going to be talking about that right now. Welcome to It's All About Food, Dr. Barnard.
Hi, it's great to be with you today.
Yes, thank you so much. Thank you for all the work you've been doing for decades now. You've made a major contribution in making this world a better place, and I can't thank you enough for that.
Well, that's nice of you to say. We're not done yet.
There's so much work to do. And that's why we need to keep our brains sharp.
That's right, we do. And a lot of people, when they're stacking up their breakfast, they don't realize that it could affect not only how they feel during the day, you know, that kind of brain fog that some people have, that could be affected by your food, but also the long-term risks, like the poor memory that some folks get when they're older, or even something as serious as Alzheimer's disease. Research has shown very strong links with what we eat, and so I wrote Power Foods for the Brain to try to help people to understand how that works and what the science is behind it.
Now, all diseases are unpleasant and scary. I think Alzheimer's and dementia are probably the scariest, in my opinion, just because losing our minds, and what else is there when we lose our minds, and it's so hard for our family and friends to cope with, and it seems like after reading your book, there's a great deal of hope. Can we really avoid dementia and Alzheimer's?
Yeah, I think we can to a very substantial degree. And just so that people are clear with the terms, dementia means the loss of mental function. Your memory's not good, but it's a generic term. And the most common type of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. And there are other types, like you could have a stroke, where part of the brain is destroyed, and so your memory is poor for that reason, or Parkinson's disease or other conditions can cause poor memory. But the most common cause is Alzheimer's, and yes, there's a lot that we can do about it. Research has looked at what people eat, and there are certain dietary patterns that are linked with a higher risk and other dietary patterns that are linked with a dramatically lower risk, and so that's all we need to do is kind of plug that in, plus other parts of lifestyle like exercise that play roles as well.
Well, I'm interested, the more I read about Alzheimer's, is this thing with the plaque in the brain. And we're learning more about heart disease and diabetes and how plaque in the arteries can have such a detrimental effect. But I'm not surprised that plaque in the brain as well can be caused by certain foods.
Yes. Now, plaque is just a generic word. Your dentist might say, well, you have plaque on your teeth. Mm-hmm. It just means a collection of something. And in your arteries, there are what are called atherosclerotic plaques. And if you were to open a person's coronary arteries and look inside, you would see them. They look a bit like chewing gum, except their heart is a rock, and that's atherosclerotic plaque. Inside the brain, it's different. These plaques or collections are microscopic, little round blobs that look sort of like meatballs or balls of yarn, and they are collections of protein that have developed in the brain. But they are not normal, they shouldn't be there, and we now know a bit about how foods might cause them to collect.
Okay, so let's talk about a few of them. My favorite foods, meat and dairy, not...
Right. Well, in Chicago, a research study got started in 1993, 20 years ago. And they tracked what people ate over time, and 10 years later, in 2003, they published some astounding findings that people who tended to tuck into bacon, cheese, the foods that are high in saturated fat, that seemed to be an issue. Saturated fat is solid fat. It's mostly in, well, dairy products are the number one source, cheese, whole milk, and so forth. Meat is the second source, also eggs. And the people who ate the most saturated fat had 2 to 3 times the risk of Alzheimer's disease compared to people who ate the least. And then secondly, trans fats, which are the hardened oils that are used in donuts and sometimes fryer grease, shortening, you could call it. The people who tended to eat that had probably 3 to 5 times the risk of Alzheimer's disease compared to people who ate the least. So you put those two things together. The bad fats really increase risk. But then they looked further, and they found there are certain things that reduce risk as well.
Now, I'm a vegan. I've been a vegan for 25 years. I encourage everyone to fall in love with plants. But I'm continually hearing all different kinds of things, and many nutritionist doctors recommend low-fat dairy. So would that be okay?
Well, it doesn't have the saturated fat in it, but if you skim the fat out of milk, the number one nutrient left in it is sugar. It's lactose sugar is the main nutrient that's in skim milk, and which is why the calorie content of cow's milk is very similar to a typical soda.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different kind of sugar, but it's still there, and it's there to make the calf fat and to give energy to the growing calf, but it's not there for us adult humans. That's not the point of it, so we're better off avoiding it.
Okay. Now, some of the scary things that I read about, there are things that we thought were important nutrients like iron and things that are being added into our food like breakfast cereals that aren't good for us.
Well, you do need a little bit of iron in your diet. There's no question about that. You need it for healthy hemoglobin in your red blood cells that lets them carry oxygen. However, iron is a double-edged sword. If you don't have enough, you'll be anemic. If you have too much, you're iron overloaded. And in the brain, the iron appears to oxidize. It rusts, in essence, and that causes the creation of free radicals that can damage the brain. Copper is very similar. You need copper for enzymes in the body, but if you have too much, it oxidizes too. Think of a penny that as it gets older, it corrodes and turns dark. That oxidation process happens in your body too.
So we need a little, but not too much.
Not too much, and it's easy to get too much. If you grew up the way I did in a meaty kind of diet, that sort of environment is going to lead you to overdose, unfortunately.
Mm.
And many people do. What are the sources of copper? It's not just the copper pipes that you might have. Shellfish, like lobster, crab, shrimp, loaded with copper, and something like liver is high in both copper and iron, and it really has levels that are, I would say, toxic.
I remember as a kid we used to always say liver makes you live, but I don't think so.
No. Keep in mind what the liver's, keep in mind what the job is of the liver. Your liver's got a rough job. It's there to clean toxins out of your blood.
Yeah.
So if you're eating a pig's liver, a chicken's liver, a cow's liver, you're eating, it's basically like tearing open your air conditioner and eating its filter.
Mm.
That's where all the junk is. So, no. And frankly, people shouldn't be eating animal products in any way, shape, or form. We are not natural carnivores, but those who do seem to relish these particularly unhealthy parts of the animal.
Okay, there was something that I read about that I loved reading about that I didn't know about, and that is I've read many times over the years about the difference of the kinds of iron, plant iron, non-heme iron, and the animal iron, the iron we get from animal foods, and how they were different, and how the plant-based one was, some would say, less absorbable. But in your book, I learned how that's a good thing sometimes, that the plant-based iron really works with us.
Well, right. We're designed for plant-based iron. If you consume green leafy vegetables, for example, spinach or broccoli or any of the others, they have non-heme iron. That's a special form that is more absorbable if you need it, but less absorbable if you already have a lot of iron on board already. That's your body's homeostatic mechanism for maintaining iron balance. The iron that's in meat is to a large degree heme iron, and that defies your body's ability to control it. And people are not meat eaters by nature, and if you eat meat, your risk of becoming iron overloaded is very high.
I mean, how lovely is that about iron?
Well, it's the body, the human body adapted to the plants that were around it. And that's why we can absorb iron from plant-based foods, and we can keep it out if we've got too much. That's also why when you go into the produce counter, the red color of a tomato, the green color of greens, the orange color of a carrot, that's beta-carotene, what your retina can see is the nutrients in these foods at a great distance. You see the lycopene in a tomato, it registers on the retina as bright red. The anthocyanins, which are also antioxidants in blueberries and grapes, that registers in your brain as deep purple colors. Our bodies are designed to seek out and take advantage of the nutrients in plant foods, and we just take that for granted. Aren't the tomatoes pretty? Well, not just pretty. That's the lycopene that's an antioxidant screaming out at you to eat it. So we have adapted these abilities to detect delicious, healthful foods and also to be repelled by other things. Fish doesn't smell so hot. If you go into the meat counter, nobody's going to say, what a lovely aroma. It stinks.
Mm-hmm.
And that is nature trying to tell you to get away from those foods.
Okay, I just got a question from a listener, and I'm going to ask you. She writes, my dad was a slim, healthy eater all his life, got plenty of omega-3s, ate mostly fruits and vegetables, especially blueberries, drank red wine, ran marathons well into his late 70s, was a scholar, New York Times crossword puzzler, an active lawyer, until Alzheimer's robbed him of his skills around the same time. He died at 84. 5 years after his diagnosis, his mother and father had it. A younger sister also had it. And she's asking, so if they all had it, why should she think that she could avoid it?
Okay, well, first of all, that's a terrific question, but I'm very, very sorry for your loss. It's a horrible thing to see a family member start to get this condition where everything that ever mattered to them is ripped away bit by bit. And when you see this happen to a family member, you would trade it for just any other, give me any disease other than Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
However, there is a gene called the APOE epsilon 4 allele. And if you've got it from one parent, your risk of Alzheimer's is tripled. If you got it from both parents, it's multiplied by a factor of 10 to 15. So
wow.
some people have considered that a death sentence. It is not. We have learned what that gene does. What the gene does is it does not cause Alzheimer's. What it does is it causes a protein to be formed in the body, a carrier protein, that escorts cholesterol from place to place. And if people avoid animal products, if they're not making much cholesterol, and they're not eating cholesterol, and they're not eating the saturated fat or the trans fats at all, their risk of memory problems later in life plummets dramatically. There are genes for lung cancer, but if you don't smoke, you may never get it. So we should all assume that we're at risk, whatever your genes may be, and that what we need to do is then to get the animal products out of our diet completely. You already knew you wanted to do that for your heart and for your waistline and, frankly, for the animals' benefit and for a better earth. And there's every single reason to build your diet from grains and beans and vegetables and fruits, but Alzheimer's is the latest reason for that. And in researchers in Finland looked at people who had were around age 50 and they were all reasonably healthy. Those who avoided saturated fats had an 80% reduction in their risk of memory problems in later life, even when they had the genes.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a reason to not fool around with this. It's a reason to make a big change in your diet. In the same way as a smoker does not fool around, you don't sort of cut down. You throw the cigarettes away.
Right.
If you're a meat eater, if you're eating animal products, get away from them. And a healthy diet is four groups: vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, and take vitamin B12, which your brain needs. If you do those things, those four food groups and that B12 supplement, you've got 98% of it licked.
I love the way my plate looks a lot like the PCRM's plate.
Yeah, well,
did
it was 2009.
Did you have some secret representative in the government pushing?
No. I mean, that's, well, it was 2009. We, PCRM, my group, the Physicians Committee, went to the USDA, and we said the pyramid is a nice shape, but nobody eats from a pyramid. We need to be more literal and make a plate. And so we sent them the what we call the power plate. It was a plate divided into four quadrants. And we sent an official petition to the Department of Agriculture saying, please adopt this. And 2 years later, after not having heard back from them, they issued this thing they called My Plate, which is four quadrants. And I'm not taking credit for it, but it looks remarkably similar to what
it
we sent.
It sure
them.
Does. Only yours is better.
Well, thank you. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, we don't need that little extra circle on the outside of milk products.
Well, yeah, they put in, we did not include dairy, and they put in a little extra circles to say, here's your glass of milk, but you really can't make a case that milk is in any way necessary. It's the number one source of saturated fat, and people who avoid milk have every bit as strong of bones as people who consume milk.
Okay, one more food question, and that is about fish, because a lot of people, when they're diagnosed with some sort of dementia, their doctors say you need to eat fish.
Right. Well, fish do have omega-3 fatty acids. Those are the good fats. That's true. Having said that, 70 to 85% of the fat in fish is not omega-3. It's a mixture of saturated fat and various forms of unsaturated fat. So fish also have a lot of contaminants in them. Tuna have a lot of mercury, and there are others as well, of course. I already mentioned the problems with shellfish.
Mm-hmm.
But fish, if you're eating fish muscle, which is what you're eating, it's a lot more like cow muscle than it is like broccoli. It's just not health food. So we recommend, if somebody wants to have good fats, there are traces of good fats in green leafy vegetables and beans. If you want to have a little bit more, you'll find them in walnuts, some soy products. If you want to go crazy, you can get exactly fish oil, but it's from plant-based sources. At any health food store, they'll sell you DHA capsules. I don't think anyone really needs it, but if you wanted them, it's there and in a much cleaner form than in fish.
Okay, very good. So that's the food portion, but there's a lot more that we can do to take care of our brains. And you talk about sleep and what happens when we're sleeping.
It's fascinating. You know, all day long you have experiences. You learn things, you have interactions, and sleep. Why do we sleep? Well, the brain's got to file things at some point. You've had all these experiences. They're piling up on your desk like so many file folders. When you go to sleep, your brain can make sense of things and sort of reset itself and file away your memories of the day so you can find them later, speaking metaphorically. The first half of the night, the brain emits what are called slow waves, sleep brain waves, which we can measure with an EEG. That's when we're remembering and integrating memories. The second half of the night is REM sleep, rapid eye movement, when you're dreaming. And that's when the brain is integrating emotion. So if you're up all night, your memory will be poor, but your emotional control will be poor too. You'll be grumpy or giddy or switch back and forth between the two. So sleep is important. I encourage everyone to go to knock off at 10 o'clock, and you'll feel a whole lot better the next day.
I became a vegan a long time ago because I didn't want to kill animals, and I think we can learn so much from animals. And I really enjoyed the story where you talked about different mental exercises we can do and how I think it was a chimp or something that was better at doing this one particular thing than humans.
Yeah, this is in a lab in Kyoto, Japan, where a chimpanzee chimpanzees have this extremely remarkable memory capacity, particularly for immediate memory. And the way this test works is they have a TV screen. The chimp sits on a stool in front of the screen, and the numbers from 1 to 10 appear. But they just flash there for a second, and then they disappear, and they're replaced by blank squares. And your job is to touch the squares in numerical order. But the numbers are gone, and so it's just blank squares. So humans are okay, you know, if you flash the numbers from 1 to 10, and then the numbers disappear, and the squares are there. When the numbers disappear, you might remember the order they were in. Well, chimps can do that like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And a juvenile chimp can beat not only all the graduate students in the lab, but the world's memory expert, a man from England who could memorize a pack of cards in 30 seconds, came to compete with this juvenile chimp. and the chimp just wiped the floor with them.
It's crazy, and we can learn so much from these animals that many of them we're not treating very nicely.
Well, I have to say that the more we realize that animals deserve our respect, but we're also very different from them in many ways. We need to leave them alone, leave them off our plate, leave them out of laboratories. We can study what human beings need. And in my research work here at the Physicians Committee, we do a lot of research. We study human beings in ethical ways, and we obviously are not going to be using animals in what we do. And I think the more we focus on human beings, the better off we're going to be.
We have a lot to learn about ourselves. Now, what about exercise? That's important, too?
Yeah. Interesting study at the University of Illinois. They brought in a group of people up in years, and everyone had some memory issues. What they asked them to do was just to lace up their sneakers and go for a brisk walk 3 times a week, starting out with a 10-minute walk 3 times a week, then the next week, 15-minute walk, then the next week, 20, and then 25. They got them up to a 40-minute walk 3 times a week. And what they showed was that it actually reversed age-related brain shrinkage, particularly for the part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is the seat of memory. It increased the size of the hippocampus, but it also increased memory in organized tests, structured tests of memory. So why would it work? The reason it works, we believe, is because you're oxygenating the brain and you're getting nutrients to the brain in a way that you weren't doing before. Most people are sedentary. They're not oxygenating their brain very well, and we pay a price for it.
So basically we just have to eat some very simple plant foods, get some exercise, and life's pretty good.
Yeah, it really is, and I really encourage people to not fool around with it. Have fun with it. Go in a big way. At PCRM, we have a Kickstart program where for 21 days, you're going to do it all vegan, all the time, and we give you online support for free to do it. Every day, you get an email from Alicia Silverstone or another celebrity, and they say, hey, here's a menu for the day. Here's some recipes. Here's a cooking video you might like to watch. And people really enjoy it. We have it in English and Spanish, Mandarin, Japanese, it's in Japanese. It's also, we have one for people from India, and hundreds of thousands of people have done it, and it's good for your heart, it's good for your waistline, but it's good for your brain, too.
Well, thank you, Dr. Barnard, for writing this book. Is there anything else you want to tell us about it or what PCRM is up to these days?
Well, I hope people go to our site, PCRM.org. That's Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, PCRM.org. I hope you'll join us. I hope people will try this, but I have to also just say on a personal level, if I could turn back time and get my own father and my own mother and my grandparents on a healthy plant-based diet instead of the meaty diets that they did grow up on, I think that we could have reversed the aging that robbed them of so many years. Don't get me wrong, you're not going to live forever. But why age the brain prematurely? Why develop Alzheimer's disease if you don't have to? A generation ago, we thought heart attacks were just part of getting older. Well, we now know it's a disease that we can prevent and reverse. Alzheimer's should be thought of also as a target for prevention. Now is the time to put it to work.
Right. We should all live long, healthy, quality lives. And after about 120 or 30 or 150, who knows, we just fall asleep and move on.
Well, I'm going to die in a flaming inferno in the Monaco Formula One Grand Prix. It is 100,
okay.
150 years old, something like that. I think I'm going to overcook the corner, and that'll be it.
Okay, well, I'll see you then. Okay, thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. Dr. Barnard, thanks for writing Power Foods for the Brain. I really enjoyed reading it.
Thank you. It's been great to talk with you.
Okay. Well, that was Dr. Barnard. I wanted to mention before we take a break some things that are going on in my town in New York City. So you may be familiar with Victoria Moran. I've had her on the program. She's a wonderful author. She's recently written Main Street Vegan and Charmed Life and a whole bunch of other books. Well, she'll be speaking at the 92nd Street Y on October 29th, next week. And you can find out more at 90secondwhy.org. It's $22 and up, and you'll learn all you need to know to get from here to green, glowing, and glorious in no time. So if you need some help or want to bring someone you love to get that quick kickstart in person, that might be a good event to go to. And then another one of my wonderful friends, Fran Costigan, she's being on the show, and she'll be back on November 5th. On Monday, November 4th, she'll be at Candle Cafe West, another fabulous restaurant in New York City, actually very close to the Progressive Radio Network studio. And she will be book signing from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on November 4th, Monday, November 4th, the day before she's on my program. So there you have it. All right, why don't we take a quick little break? And you can always send me an email with a question if you have one now or later at info@realmeals.org. Visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. And now we'll take that little break. We'll be right back. Hello, everybody. We're back. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. And we have another half hour of talking about my favorite subject, food. I love food. And I don't just love it because I enjoy eating food. I love what good it can do for it if we choose the right foods. Now, food can be good and food can be bad. Are you a good food or a bad food? And we're learning more and more about which foods are health-promoting and which foods can do a little bit of damage. So the goal, as we were talking about in the last half hour, is to live a long quality life. We're all going to move on at some point. My father likes to say nobody gets out of this world alive, and that's true, but we should be living joyfully. We should be feeling good. We should be able to do as much as we want until, you know, maybe 150 years later when we get a little tired and we can move on. Okay, so let's talk about doing that some more with powerful foods, and I'm going to bring on my second guest, Dr. David Katz. He's the founding director of Yale University's Prevention Research Center. He received his BA from Dartmouth College, his MD from Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and his MPH from the Yale University School of Public Health. He's a two-time diplomat of the American Board of Internal Medicine, a board-certified specialist in preventative medicine, public health, and a clinical instructor in medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. And so much more. You can go to responsibleeatingandliving.com and read more of all the wonderful things that Dr. David Katz has been up to, but right now we're going to be talking about his new book, Disease Proof. Welcome to It's All About Food, Dr. Katz.
Thank you, Karen. Good to be with you.
Yeah, so I'm sure you don't remember this, but a few years back I was on the Dr. Oz show. It was one of these anti-cancer prevention shows, and I told my story, and then you came on and were pointing out all the colorful, wonderful plant foods and what to eat, and that's when I first learned about you.
Ah, very nice.
Live and in person. Anyway, so let's talk about your book, Disease Proof. Now, my first question for you is, how did you get so smart and make the connection between food and health? Because most doctors who were trained about the time you were really haven't gotten that message.
They've sort of dropped that ball. Yeah, that's really too bad. So, you know, the title, Disease Proof, really tells the story. We can, to a remarkable degree, use food as medicine, use lifestyle as medicine. And the evidence is incontrovertible that we could cut our lifetime risk of all major chronic disease, heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, dementia, by a staggering 80%. There's nothing in all of biomedical advance to rival that. There's never been a Nobel Prize for anything that could rival that potential. So that's why I'm in that space. You know, essentially, I naturally gravitate toward the big picture. When I was training in medicine, taking care of really sick people in the hospital, I couldn't help but notice how often hospital beds were filled with desperately sick and very unhappy people who never needed to get that sick in the first place. So I did a subsequent residency in preventive medicine. And focusing on disease prevention, if you're paying attention, it isn't long before you fall in love with the transformative power of lifestyle as medicine. And then the issue becomes, you know, as you really work in that space year after year after year, gee, the problem isn't that we don't know what. We sure know what the medicine is. The trouble is we don't seem to know how. We don't know how to get the medicine to go down, and that's what Disease Proof is about. It's really a book about how.
Well, that's what I love about it. And I read a lot of books, a lot of diet books, a lot of books about health. And what I think my favorite piece is what you call skill power.
And I think it's a critical missing piece of the puzzle, Karen, so thank you for noting that. We talk a lot about willpower. And, you know, clearly to get any job done, you have to care. And we can call that willpower. But, you know, think of something as commonplace and mundane as riding a bicycle. You can't ride a bicycle just with willpower. You have to learn how to ride a bicycle. And generally, somebody who knows how to ride a bicycle teaches you. And then once you know how forever. So, you know, there are just all sorts of things in life that, you know, we get started because we care. And then we learn how. And that's really what skill power is. In the modern world, eating well is not the path of least resistance. And if you want to get there from here, you need a skill set to be able to identify more nutritious food, identify more nutritious food that doesn't cost more, identify opportunities to prepare nutritious food that are convenient and efficient and family-friendly, the opportunity to love food that loves you back, not trade off good taste for good health. All of this is skill-dependent. Those skills can be taught, they can be learned, and they can be applied. But you know what, Karen, and the same is true on the physical activity side. This is why I need you, and I appreciate you, you know, recognizing the importance of that, because essentially I'm bringing my reader a whole different scenario. You know, the easy way to get on a bestseller list is to promise the moon and stars, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a magical formula, just do this.
Yes.
And frankly,
there is one on the bestseller list right now that does that.
Exactly right. and there always is.
Yeah.
And so I'm saying, look, haven't we had enough? I mean, you know, if any fad diet was ever going to work, wouldn't we have already been there? The issue is this. False promises prove false. They just don't stand up over time. I want to enter into a contract with you. I have the skill set for healthy living. I'm a beneficiary of it every day. My wife is. My five children are. It's real. It's sustainable. It's not just about losing weight. It's about finding health. It's not a flash in the pan. But there is no magic. And so I can teach it. You've got to learn it. You've got to apply it. I don't have any pixie dust. My hope is readers are ready for that. You know, it's truly empowering. It's transformational. But I'm telling my readers, I can't sprout wings and fly you there. You actually have to sign up and do the job of learning this skill set. It's worth it.
I'm looking at the cover of your book, Disease Proof, The Remarkable Truth About What Makes Us Well, The Skills You Need to Slash Your Risk of Heart Disease, Cancer, Diabetes, and More by 80%. It doesn't mention weight loss. And I was curious about that because a lot of publishers want you to put weight loss on the cover because that's what people want to grab.
And it is about weight loss.
And it is about weight loss.
It is because, you know, frankly, obesity is the canary in the coal mine of chronic disease. And, you know, when you consider the burden of heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, dementia in our society, you're not going to fix that unless you fix obesity. So the book is absolutely about weight loss. But, you know, that's the easy sell. You know, lose 30 pounds in 27 minutes. I mean, you know, enough of that nonsense. I'm really interested in finding health. Now, as it turns out, you know, many people need to lose weight to find health, but it's part of a bigger story. The prize isn't a number on the scale. The prize is vitality. The prize is a better life. You know, it's basically, you know, more years in life, yes, but more life in years. And the other problem with weight loss the way we do it in our culture is it's a go-it-alone thing. You know, parents go on diets and leave their kids behind. But disease-proofing, finding health is something you absolutely want to pay forward to everybody you love. And it's one of those beautiful things where the more you share it, the better you get at it because you support one another. So, in fact, yes, Disease Proof is about losing weight if that's what you need to do. It's about more than that. It's about the true prize, a life well lived, a life, you know, vital energy to do all the things you love to do. And so, you know, there's no gimmickry, even on the cover, as you say. You know, there's no attempt to say, you know, you can lose a whole bunch of weight. Enough. It really is time for us to recognize that the basic functional unit of our lives is the family, the people that we care about. If we need to lose weight, let's do it with them. Let's not leave everybody behind. And let's find health together and share it, and share the joy of it. Life is better when you're healthy. Healthy people have more fun. And I believe everybody can get there, but I believe most people lack the skills to get there in the modern world. And, you know, again, that's the reader's part of this contract. I'm going to read the book, learn the skills, apply the skills, and accept going in that there will be no magic wand or pixie dust involved.
I like to say you don't know how good you can feel. You just don't know how good you can feel until you're on a healthier diet. And it, sometimes that's a hard sell. People don't know how good they can feel, and they just think you're blowing air.
Yeah, no, it's amazing how good you can feel. And, you know, there's some fairly obvious sort of rock back on your heels opportunities. You know, one of the things I point out, I always, you know, as a doctor, obviously, I've seen over the years patients with every imaginable condition, and, you know, many consigned to wheelchairs for various reasons. But, you know, I think there's just a basic human response to seeing somebody whose dynamism, whose vitality is limited. We see somebody in a wheelchair, and, you know, I think we feel sorry for them. You know, we hope it's temporary, but whether temporary or permanent, we think, oh, what happened? What's wrong? And that's too bad. And yet most of us, with a perfectly serviceable pair of legs, you know, don't do very much with them. We're constantly looking for an opportunity to avoid indulging our native animal vitality. I agree with you completely. If you put optimal food in, and again, you know, optimal food is not just food that's good for you. It's food that's good. This is about loving food that loves you back, and that's really the emphasis in Disease Proof. There should not be a choice between the joy of good food and the joy of good health. They should come together. Physical activity is the same. You know, I mean, if you don't like spandex or pumping iron, you know, I mean, dance. Move any way that floats your boat, but You're absolutely right, Karen. You can't imagine how good you'll feel when you cultivate vitality and set it free. Life is better. There's no question about it. And, you know, living the privilege of that, you want to share it. And you look around. I mean, I'm a 50-year-old guy with five kids and a desk job. But I weigh what I weighed when I graduated high school. I can out-hike, bike, ski, horseback ride.
You look pretty good.
Oh, thanks. You know, most people half my age, and it's not because I'm a better guy. It's because I've got a skill set.
Right.
And, I've seen so many of my patients over the years squander their vitality, and it's so sad, and it can stop. And we can pay it forward to the next generation because this is just as relevant for our kids and our grandchildren. We can give them a better life and a better future if we disease-proof ourselves.
This skill power thing, I'm really liking it a lot, and I like how you put that when you have a goal, something you want to do, you have to learn the skills to get there. And it's very empowering because a lot of people knock themselves when they have to lose weight or when they're hit with a debilitating disease or something physically bothers them, and it's easy to blame themselves or easy to say, I can't do this. But when you realize everything we've done in life, we've learned how to do. You have to learn. I like to say, find your kitchen. I say this all the time. My listeners have heard me say it probably too many times. But we don't know how to make food. We don't know what we're eating. We have to learn.
Exactly, and that's a skill too. And just a quick example. Of course, you know, the several hundred pages of the book are filled with, you know, the skills for this, that, and the other thing. But just a quick example of the advantages of skill power, because, you know, when you rely on willpower, what you're trying to do is hard. You're sort of trying to do what you don't want to do or trying not to do what you do want to do. And an example would be, I've got a sweet tooth. I eat too much sweets. I should stop. It's making me fat and sick. And, you know, the willpower approach to that problem is I have to give up dessert. But you want dessert. It's calling out to you. You know, so there's a desperate struggle there, and usually in time you lose. You know, when you make the decision, your willpower is at its peak. You take the leap based on inspiration, like the New Year's resolution. You know, the New Year's resolution never lives to see the crocuses come up because it wears off. So that's the skill power the willpower approach. I have a sweet tooth. I've got to give up dessert. The skill power approach, and we lay this out in detail in the book, is there's actually stealth sugar hiding in all sorts of foods you never realized were sweet in the first place. Every supermarket in the country sells marinara sauces side by side on the shelf. One has more added sugar than ice cream topping, and the other has none. And you wouldn't even notice the difference because you're not looking for it. Well, once you learn to look for it, and you choose the one that doesn't have the sugar. And you do the same when you buy salad dressing and crackers and chips and breads and so forth. Well, the net effect of this is you've taken gram after gram after gram of sugar out of your daily diet, and you're already much better off because you don't have all that sugar, you don't have all those calories. If you did nothing else, you'd be better off than when you started. But because you're now no longer bathing your taste buds in all of that sugar that was hiding in foods, they wake up. They come out of their coma. They go through rehab, and they become more sensitive to the sugar that you are still eating. And all of a sudden, that dessert you thought you loved starts to taste a little too sweet. And now giving it up and, you know, trading it for something better is no longer dependent on willpower. It's actually something you want to do. And so, you know, you can rehabilitate your taste preferences by trading up choices that are easy to do. And then the rising tide lifts all boats, and you actually start to improve all of the choices you make. And again, you know, because you become more sensitive to sugar, you're not sacrificing sugar. You actually prefer food less sweet. And that, you know, sets you well on your way toward loving food that loves you back. You do the same thing with salt. You do the same thing with other aspects of nutrition. There's an enormous opportunity to apply skill and relieve the burden we place on will. And, you know, what we wind up doing is we ask too much of willpower. It lasts a while. It wears out.
Mm-hmm.
We fall off the wagon. And then not only did we fail to get the health results we wanted, but we blame ourselves for our failure, and we beat up on ourselves, and we self-recriminate, and, you know, it's a very toxic thing. Well, you know, again, if you're trying to ride a bike and don't know how, you'll keep falling off until you give up. If you know somebody who knows how to ride a bike and is willing to teach you and you're willing to learn, you know, a few easy lessons, you will know how to ride that bike for the rest of your life. The skills for being healthy are much the same.
Now, most Americans are on a very bad diet, and over the last 100 years, especially the last 50 years, through industrialization and marketing and changes in our food system and government subsidies and tax structures, we have been encouraged to make bad choices. And here we are. We're in a really bad situation. Our disease care is thriving.
Yes, it is.
And our economy is not.
Right.
And so many people, unfortunately, are suffering. So I see this book as something really basic that can help most Americans move to a better place.
No question. Thank you, Karen. And in fact, I do the same. I tie it in with, you know, the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, and you know, health care reform, because really what's being reformed is disease care. And, you know, I'm a supporter of the reform, but it's the tip of the iceberg. You know, the CDC is projecting that unless we disease-proof ourselves to a substantial degree, 1 in 3 Americans will be diabetic by the middle of this century. Well, that's 100 million people with diabetes. We only have 27 million now, and we can't pay the bills already.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, the power to transform our personal fate, the fate of our family, and probably the fate of our nation resides more with each of us than anywhere else. So, you know, we can make our nation more vital, more solvent, by making ourselves healthier. And this is true health care reform, but nobody else is going to do this for you. The power resides with you. It's an extraordinary opportunity. It's totally evidence-based. You know, we make the case right on the cover of the book, 80% reduction in chronic disease. Well, you know, that's not plucked out of the air. We cite study after study after study, confirming that we can do exactly that. We cite the study showing that DNA is not destiny. There are studies to show you can alter gene expression in a way that changes your risk for developing cancer or redeveloping cancer or for cancer progressing. This is also a book for people who have chronic disease and want to modify the course of chronic disease. We have incredible latent power. We like to say, Karen, that knowledge is power.
Mm-hmm.
But that's only true if you use it. And again, knowing what but not knowing how and failing to put, you know, the promise of an 80% reduction in chronic disease to use, that's an incredible lack of power. This book is designed to fix that. It's an empowering dose of really transformative truth. And I'll do my part. You know, I'll share the relevant skills. as long as the reader does their part and says, okay, I'm not going to look for magic here. I want the practical magic of skill power. I'm willing to you know, sign that contract and do my part of the bargain and learn how to do this.
You've mentioned a number of different diets that people are following these days, and there's a bunch of them where there are a lot of similarities and then some clear differences. And I'm a vegan. I've been a vegan for 25 years, and I'm quite passionate about it because I never wanted to kill animals, and I realized the powerful impact on the environment and as well as health. But there are unhealthy
right.
vegans, and there
yeah.
are all kinds of vegan diets. And there's all kinds of diets, period. But then when you start to fine-tune, there's all kinds of whatever it is you're following, and there's all kinds of paleo diets now, and they're all over the place. And you mentioned them, and I found that your approach was pretty all-encompassing.
Thank you. Well, you know, I don't have a dog in the race, for one thing. I don't care which diet is best for health. I'm not an ideologue. I care about the truth, and so I review the evidence objectively. And I've done this in a number of contexts. Right now, I'm finishing up the third edition of my nutrition textbook for physicians and other healthcare professionals, Nutrition and Clinical Practice. That has over 5,000 scientific references in it, so it's a bird's-eye view of the relevant literature. I'm a best diet reviewer for U.S. News and World Report, and I recently finished an invited peer-reviewed paper for annual reviews in public health entitled, Can We Say What Diet is Best for Health? And my job in all of these situations is to objectively review all of the evidence. And the answer is, Karen, first of all, you know, I fully support your veganism, and I think veganism done well is kinder, gentler, better for the planet, and clearly one of the contenders for best diet laurels. But not everybody wants to be a vegan, and it's a mistake to assert that, you know, being a vegan is the only way to have a healthy diet. Well, you know, what about that Mediterranean diet? You know, there are as many variations on the Mediterranean diet in the blue zones as there are low-fat plant-based diets, and there are more than there are vegan diets. So, you know, essentially what's very well established in the scientific literature, if we're talking about health, is the basic theme of healthy eating for human beings. We are not clueless about the basic care and feeding of Homo sapiens. We know that theme. Frankly, Michael Pollan pretty much nailed it, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And then there's room for variation on that theme. It could be only plants. It could be vegan. You know, it could be vegetarian, where you include dairy and eggs. It could be pesca-vegetarian. It could be a Mediterranean-style diet. There are variations on that theme. And the beauty of that is, you know, it's the truth about what we know. It's the truth about what we don't know. And it's the latitude for you to be in charge of your life. I tell every one of my patients, and I tell my readers, I'm not the boss of you. My job is to, you know, to do my job, to be an expert, provide expert guidance and knowledge, impart it to you, and then let you choose how to use it to suit your life. And the fact that there are variations on the theme of optimal eating puts you in the driver's seat where you belong, and you've chosen to drive toward veganism. It's an excellent choice. It's not a choice everybody's going to make, and I think that's okay. You could choose an omnivorous Mediterranean diet, and as long as it's mostly plants, the evidence we have suggests that in terms of human health outcomes, it's just as good. You know, and if you combine that with whatever animal products you eat, choosing them very carefully and being sensitive to issues of how the animals are being treated and how they're raised, and then potentially that too can soften the impact we're having on the earth. I think that's an important issue. There's 7 billion of us.
Yeah,
that's a game changer. You know, I mean, we have to think differently about food when there's 7 billion of us. You know, even if it's good for human health to be omnivorous, we have to change the way we're omnivorous, just because there's so many of us and the high environmental cost of that. But, you know, again, I don't advance a particular diet because of ideology. In fact, I wrote a column for the Huffington Post a while back entitled "Separation of Church and Plate." And I find people just argue for their favorite diet with a great deal of religious zealotry, and they leave the science behind. And the clearest indication of that, Karen, is that equally smart, equally credentialed people make mutually exclusive claims, you know, that the problem is all fructose, or, you know, lately we're hearing the problem is wheat and gluten.
Yeah.
But we've got other people, you know, with just as many adherents arguing that the problem all along was animal food, or the problem is just dairy, or the, you know, so, you know, if any one of them's right, all the others are wrong. More logically, they're all just latching onto one piece of the available evidence and sort of falling in love with their particular hypothesis. I don't indulge myself in that. I'm very careful not to do it.
Well, here's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see everybody get healthy. I'd like to see everybody reducing their animal products and their junk food products and eating more plant foods. And when everybody's fit and trim and healthy, then we can really start talking about the ideal diet, and we'll have a bigger pool of people to deal with.
I totally agree with you, because, you know, the one thing that's perfectly clear is that we're a hell of a long way from there now.
Yeah.
And we are reaping the whirlwind. You know, it's just incredible what's going on all around us that we accept as normal. You know, again, a 50-year-old guy, people my age routinely drop dead of a heart attack. I mean, I just can't imagine the possibility of that. You know, there's just so much energy and vitality at this stage in my life. And, you know, our kids are succumbing to what used to be adult-onset diseases. Type 2 diabetes in childhood should not exist. It shouldn't exist. A generation ago, it just didn't exist, and it keeps getting worse. So, you know, we're allowing this to happen. We talk about junk food as if it's a legitimate food group. You know, we wouldn't build anything we care about out of junk.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't build a house out of junk. You wouldn't build a car out of junk, a smartphone.
Well, some people do, yeah.
Well, maybe. But the idea that we, you know, sort of look on and complacently watch the growing bodies of children and grandchildren we love get constructed out of junk, it's almost shocking. So, you know, it's the sort of thing when you take the blinders off, you say, wow, what were we doing? But that only takes you so far. Okay, now I know there's a problem. I want to do something about it, but I don't know how to fix it. Well, that's what we have to change. And if everybody's empowered to be the solution in their own life, I'm with you. I think we could get there. And then, absolutely, you know, once we've come a long way out of
the fence. Well, you know how we have to get there, David? We have to have our doctors especially telling us this, because many doctors don't. They quickly brush over, oh, you could change your diet and you can, but here's a pill. And a lot of people think their doctor is God.
Yeah, well, I don't know. They used to, Karen. I mean, as a doctor myself, I see less and less of that. In fact, people, you know, they routinely surf the Internet. They come in with information, and what I encounter often is that somebody who spent 2 hours surfing the net thinks they know as much as, you know, somebody who's had 9 years of postgraduate education. So, you know, I think we can err in both directions. So, you know, anybody listening who thinks their doctor is God, they're not. They're not God. They're fallible. I totally agree with you that doctors should be part of the solution, and I'm working very hard to make that so. Along with 3 editions of a nutrition textbook, teaching nutrition to medical students and residents, my colleagues and I have also developed a free online course for doctors that offers continuing medical education credit called Online Weight Management Counseling for Healthcare Professionals. Mm. We talk about that in the book. But where we may differ, Karen, I'm not sure we do, but I, as a doctor myself, I think doctors are a very small part of the solution here, because fundamentally, this, at its origins, this is not a clinical problem. It's a cultural problem. You know, doctors and clinics and hospitals and the biomedical establishment, we're about treating disease. We do very little to build health at its origins.
Mm-hmm.
Health is built with lifestyle, and it's built in the places we live and love and learn and work and pray and play. And doctors have very little influence over all of that. So the advice they give should be good. The guidance they offer should be relevant. The counseling we do should be constructive and compassionate. I've always argued that if you just wag your finger at a patient and say, don't you realize you should lose weight, you make them feel about an inch tall. And if they, you know, their height goes down and their weight doesn't, you've actually raised their body mass index. Talk about counterproductive. So, you know, all of that's got to stop, clearly. We can do better than that. But this is a cultural problem. We need cultural medicine to solve it. And frankly, you know, culture begins under our roof. We talk about family values. Well, health can be a family value, and then the culture of your household starts to take you toward health. And again, I think Disease Proof offers the exact skill set to set that in motion. That's what it's for.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for joining me on It's All About Food. Thank you for all the work that you're doing, and you're somebody who definitely walks the walk, and we need more like you.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's a pleasure to join you.
Okay, be well.
You too.
Okay, that's it.
All
it's
right.
All about food. Thank you.
All right, very good.
Bye-bye. We've come to the end of It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass. Send me an email. I love to hear from you. info@realmeals.org and visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, because that's really what it's all about, I think, anyway. All right. Have a delicious week.